and one stroke can create several notes. Yeah. And then you can do rhythmic things, so like these strings I mentioned. You can combine horizontal and vertical playing like. And then the bass string for more robust kind of like sound like.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, and today's guest is the genre-defying sitarist and composer Mohammed Ahsani. In this episode, a couple of compositions from his album Wayfinder are featured. Wayfinder incorporates a range of stylistic influences, including South Asian classical, Middle Eastern, jazz, funk, Western classical, ambient and electronic music, and it was produced by Juno and Emmy-nominated producer Adam Shaikh. Mohammed is a wonderful educator based in Vancouver, Canada, and teaching online, and I'm so grateful for him for being so gracious in agreeing to demonstrate on both sitar and tabla some basics of these instruments and of stylistic elements in South Asian music for this episode. You can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com, where you can sign up for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks for upcoming episodes. This is the final episode for Season 3, and Season 4 launches January 6th, so do check out episodes you may have missed from the first three seasons. I'm an independent podcaster, and I truly need the help of my listeners to keep this project going. You'll find a link in the description to help with that. Hi, Mohammed. Thanks so much for joining me here today.
It's an absolute pleasure, Leah. Wonderful to be here speaking with you this afternoon.
I do love South Asian music, and I'm a particular fan of the sitar, so I'm so happy because you're actually the first sitar player I've had on the series, which features, you know, music from all over the world, so that's great.
Yeah. I'm delighted and honored to be here on your show.
I was interested to learn that it was certainly not your first instrument. In fact, you started as an adult.
Yes, I started as an adult. Not many people know that. My first instrument was the bass guitar. Then I was born in Pakistan, and when I was 17, I became interested in Western music, and like it was the first time I heard it, Beethoven's symphony, and I thought, wow, this is mind-blowing stuff. So I decided to study the piano, and I traveled to England and I studied piano. And for the best part of my life, I thought I was going to be a pianist. But then at my college, I came upon this incredible sitar player, who's, in my opinion, one of the best sitarists in the world. And he happened to be a visiting lecturer at my college for 1 month. So that kind of influenced me. And I thought, okay, maybe I should learn sitar. And it still took me a while after that to actually find a teacher. And then I started playing the sitar.
So who was that you heard?
It was Ustad Nishad Khan. Mm-hmm. He belonged to he was like a seventh generation musician. So his long lineage, and his family actually virtually carried the sitar from its you know, inception to where it is now. Mm-hmm. And they've always been there at the forefront of it. So yeah, amazing. So I was fortunate to have that kind of exposure. And also, like in the West, not many people know, like Ravi Shankar is more famous because of the Beatles, but a lot of the musicians I admire this style of playing beyond any other style in instrumental music in India. Mm-hmm. and Pakistan and the subcontinent. Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering, in terms of what we call it, because Hindustani is often the term used for the music of northern India. But of course, people in Bangladesh and Pakistan play this music as well.
Excellent point. Excellent point. India was a huge country before the British invaded. Even parts of Afghanistan were incorporated, and it was like an ever-changing map, basically. Sometime it was bigger than, it definitely was much bigger than it is now. In 1947, Pakistan, became, India was, became independent. And as often happens with colonization, when there's a breakup, there's a, you know, things break up into pieces, not just one whole country. The country is never the same. The fabric of the society has changed. So that led to a huge event in history, in our recent history, where India and Pakistan became separated, including Bangladesh. There are still repercussions of that tragedy that happened, and we are still living in that now. So, but the musically speaking, you see, India, Pakistan share like north of India and Pakistan share the same heritage culturally. We speak, I'm from Pakistan, I speak Urdu. In India, north of India, a lot of people speak Hindi. It's exactly the same grammar, vocabulary is slightly different. So we understand people from India, and Indians from the north understand Urdu. Very widely spoken language. So musically as well, the heritage is the same. But what happened, unfortunately, politics comes into play. And in India, they adopted the instrumental music as like a symbol of their, nationhood and so on. In Pakistan, Pakistan embraced voice. So you got incredible vocalists from Pakistan, not so many instrumentalists. There's not that many government support, but in India, there's a huge infrastructure and thousands of people. But anyway, that's just a brief kind of backdrop. So again, I think that these terms are changing. And recently I hear the word South Asian quite a lot. Because then it means India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, which I think is a fair term. So that I also use that term, South Asian. And then more specifically, what you mentioned, Hindustani, is a very kind of like a specific. So it's not all of Indian music. It's just the North Indian music, and North Indian music includes north of India from the past, which includes places like Pakistan and so on. So, that's Hindustani music is same as South Asian music, in the spirit that I was saying, that it includes music from North India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and so on. I hope that's
explained. So I'll just mention to my listeners, so previously on the series, I featured a Carnatic violinist who lives in Mississauga, Subhadra Vijay Kumar, and also one other Hindu, South Asian musician who plays the bansuri, the flutes, Milind Date, who actually we did the call from his home in Pune, India, which was kind of cool. Right.
That's
cool. So let's get to the instrument before we go on to discuss other things. Could you, for those people watching the video, and I'll alert the podcast listeners to the fact that all these episodes are available on my YouTube channel.
Yeah. Okay. So my instrument has 18 strings. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to tune it in front of you so you can get, it's already tuned, but I'm just doing some fine tuning. So I have a bass string. I have various accompanying strings. Now I have sympathetic strings. So I've tuned the top strings, which I have bass, drone, and then again I have tonic notes an octave apart. So these are the rhythmic string and drone string, bass. Then I have the melodic string. Thank you. Underneath, I have sympathetic strings here. And again, if when I'm in a concert, it will, probably will take me 3 to 4 minutes, 5 minutes to tune. Mm-hmm. If the weather is bad, then it might take longer. There's too much light. Also, these keys mm-hmm. are kind of like carved. So sometimes they slip. So you saw me when I was doing it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I have to put a lot of pressure. But, you know, you have to be on top of the tuning. Because when you have like 18 strings, to have the spectrum of the sound like in really harmonizing with each other, that is that what brings beauty to this instrument, good tuning. Mm-hmm. So like sometimes people joke like, oh, if it's a very well tuned harp, even a mouse runs across, it will create beautiful music. Mm-hmm. Right. So in a way, I'm just in a joking way. Sitar as well, like, you know, the first thing is the tuning. Once the tuning is, you know, done really well, then the instrument speaks quite well, you know. And on my sitar, I can also play it vertically and horizontally. So I can play like a guitar. But I can play bending. So that's like a singing style, right? Like you are connecting two different notes in one phrase, like as if it was one breath. So this is a mizrab that I wear. It's a plectrum. Mm-hmm. It's made of metal. And one stroke can create several notes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you can do rhythmic things. So like these strings I mentioned, you can combine horizontal and vertical playing like then the bass string for more robust kind of like sound like. That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. My hand needs to be warmed up.
Well, thanks for that little demo. That's wonderful. That's just to that. So the curved frets, they were a later development in the instrument?
Yes, yeah, the curved frets are a later development. So a little bit about the history of the instrument is that there was a famous poet. He's also revered as like a saint, philosopher, musician, poet, and so on. His name was Hazrat Amir Khusro. And his family had migrated from what is known as Afghanistan now to India, and there was a time during the Mughal rule in India and before that there was a lot of migration from Central Asia into specifically north of India, and then north of India was also ruled by the Mughals, which were the Persian background, and so they were like the biggest patrons of art in India. So the Indian music before 13th century was like associated with religious music predominantly and folk music. But when the Mughals came, they kind of like secularized music. Music was considered as a sacred entity. And so it became secularized. And as you can see in their architect, they were very much into arts and showing off, basically. Mm-hmm. So like, if you look at the Taj Mahal, was built by the Mughals, and you can see emeralds and rubies and, you know, decadence and like art and symmetry. And, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on beauty. So it's known that like at times there were like more than 400 musicians from out, like from places like Afghanistan on the payroll of these kings who kind of like patronized the music. And that continued until the British came, but when the Mughal rule ended, and then a lot of musicians were displaced. There was also another very interesting genre of music, which is called the Tumri. Mm-hmm. Tumri, it was in the beginning, and to still present day, was mainly sung by female artists. But initially, they were sung by courtesans. And these courtesans, so the aristocrats in those days used to send their boys, I suppose, to these courtesans to learn about culture, to learn about music, to about poetry, because these courtesans were very well versed in music, poetry, and dance, and that evolved a beautiful musical genre where these courtesans were known for their singing and can kind of appreciate it for that. But these were all also again displaced when the British came. So that's like a very interesting history of how, you know, the music was and how the politics kind of like changed it. But sitar was definitely patronized by the Mughals. And so initially the sitar is like a Persian word, which means three strings. Mm-hmm. And but it being in India, since the 13th century, it incorporated a lot of influences from India and Indian music as well. So I would say that for me, sitar and North Indian music is a hybrid to me. Mm-hmm. It's got too many influences. So for example, if I tell you about sitar, I can play something like Rag Sham, which is, Sham is also no name of a god in Hinduism. But I'm playing with a Mizrab, which is an Arabic word. Sitar is a Persian word. And, what I play, Bandish. There are so many amazing kind of like influences that work together in this sphere of music from South Asia, the classical music. So to me, sitar, you know, has influences and it's a hybrid instrument. So coming back to the curves, flat, yeah. So, you know, I mentioned to you Nishat Khan, who was the artist that I was fortunate to spend a month with. His uncle, his brother's, his father's brother, brought this invention not that long ago. So you can see the fret. The frets are curved. Mm. I can put my finger underneath, like that. There's a gap, right? And that's what gives me the ability to actually slide. So I can do, or I can do. So that's about the frets. Mm-hmm. It changes the game because, like, the whole repertoire that I play is very lyrical. There's a lot of Yeah. So you can see I'm bending a lot of the notes when I'm doing this. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I love so much about that instrument. Now, you played the tabla before you learned the sitar?
Yes.
And do you still teach some tabla?
I teach tabla, yeah. I teach tabla. I also like, I teach like very intense courses on the use of rhythm in composition and in your playing, because like whatever I do rhythmically, I can do it on the sitar. So I think, because like in one thing in this style of music, you learn the instrument, you learn everything, but then you move into like micro beats and so on, and that makes it really interesting. So for example, like we use like 16 beat cycle a lot in classical music. So one thing that we do is that like we're working in, or even if we worked in 8 beats, what we do is we use half notes, right? So then we end up with 16 notes in 8 beats, right? And then it's just like, how do you kind of like set those things up? You can do it very evenly, or you can do something like, so I'm doing 7 and 9. 1 2 1 2 1 2 3 4 5 6 7 8 9 1 2 1 2 1 2 3 these kind of thing you can make, you know, you can I do that, and I also do a lot of so these things. This is an oral tradition which means that the actual manifestation is best experienced once it's internalized. So like if it's in my head, if I understand every nook and corner of a phrase, that, you know, where this ta or thin stroke comes, and I'm feeling that, then when I'll act deliberately, will have that integrity, and you know, it will be whole from me to coming out as a whole. But if there is doubt or something in my mind, it's not going to sound great. So the aim is that whatever we do, whether it's a sitar or a tabla, we internalize the music as an oral tradition, and it's easier to explain with rhythm. So what we do is we use our hands as a measure. So like 1 2 3 4 5 6 7 8 9 10 11 12 13, this is 16 beat, 1 2, and the division is on 5 6 9 is a weak beat, 9 13 14 15 16. So this kind of like helps, this actually motion, saying and thinking about it. So, you know, that's one way of, very simple example of internalizing the music. And then once you have this measure, then you can try different permutations. I mean, this music is all about permutations. Mm-hmm. We don't have key changes. We don't have many other aspects that, you know, like that you would have in a sonata form or so on, you know. We have mostly endless variations.
Yeah. And for when you're teaching the rhythm, do you have all your students vocalize first before they touch the drums?
Yes. Vocalize is absolute. They have to know. So just like a C sharp on a piano, you know, when you ask somebody, oh, this is a C sharp, this is an E flat, or this is a D, they would know this is Sa, this is Re, this is Ga, Ma, Pa, Da, Ni, Sa. Like Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti, Do, we have Sa, Re, Ga, Ma, Pa, Da, Ni, Sa.
Aren't those the names of the notes, though? I meant the rhythms.
Yes. Oh, yeah, rhythm. I'm just interchanging between the rhythm and the... Yeah. It's the same thing for, as an example I give you. Yeah. So on tabla, do you want me to show it to you on the tabla?
Oh, if you would.
Okay.
That would be second. Thrilling. Sure.
Yeah, sure. With these instruments, the tuning is always takes at times, but I don't... That's what I kind of do. So, one second. cold. So I have like names. If you want to have a look.
Yeah. Perfect. Thank you.
So this is the right hand drum. This is the left hand drum. So left hand is the bass, right hand is the treble. So, for example, if I'm doing, there are three parts on the tabla. This is the black spot, which is called CI. CI means black, and it's made of iron dust and other stuff. It's hard. The middle stuff is skin, and then the outer ring is also skin. Each has different sonorities. For example, the middle one is very resonant, the most resonant. It's quite a sustain, right? And then the inner, the circle is crisp, more kind of short. The outer one is more crisp. So. The rhythms that we do. Yeah. So this stroke is called te. Te. Ton. Na. Ge ge. And when you put them together, it becomes dha. Dha ti dha. Terakita dha ti dha. Dha da terakita dha. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's the tabla and the stroke. So obviously, we get the students to chant the rhythms, play, and it's so phonetically it should sound the same. If I'm saying te, it should be, you know, tin, na, na na te. Mm-hmm. So that's the idea.
Wonderful.
And then again on the sitar, so nirega rega, like the notes. Nirega rega. So, and the sitar, you'll notice that for tuning, I have this thing here as well. I don't know if you can see. It's like a small bird.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So this is for fine tuning. So as you can see, I left the sitar. Now, every time I go back to sitar, I have to tune again a bit. So these are the adjustments that we have to do.
Mm-hmm. Hi, just a short break from the episode, which I hope you're enjoying so far. If you want to check out over 100 episodes you may have missed, in addition to your podcast player or YouTube, I have an extensive website, leahroseman.com, with show notes, transcripts, the complete catalog of episodes, and you can sign up there for my weekly newsletter to get access to sneak peeks of upcoming guests. Please do share your favorite episodes with your friends, follow me on social media, and share my posts. And if you can spare a few dollars to help support the series, that would be amazing, and you can find that link in the show notes. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. Now back to the episode.
There's so many places we could go. I was curious, because I know you do, as well as teaching at university, you sometimes do school residencies in Vancouver where you live. And I was interested to see that it's not just you just don't go and play, you have them participate and you have them do things like body drumming. Can you talk a little bit to that kind of outreach?
Yes, absolutely. I feel that anytime I'm working with anybody, whether it's children or adults or musicians, the only way that I can get any satisfaction, or I know that you know, this, what I'm saying is making any sense, is to do something with the participants, because and it's fun. So I believe strongly, you know, like working, and I've been in many situations where I've gone to a place for residency. I'm there for 2 days, sometime a day, sometime 3 days, and we always end up with a nice, somehow we, it just happens, we get a good performance out of everybody, and I perform with them. And I think that's the best way to, if I was a child and if I could learn something and then apply that skill at the same time, or, you know, that with the person who's an expert, I think that's, why not do that? I mean, that's a great way of, in education, I think it's really important. The cognition, like, you don't realize until it's actually done. Like speaking, you know, you can, one can study many books, but when you live in a country where a language is spoken, that's where you really start to make sense of, you know, how to speak, get confident. Music is the same, that, you know, like by doing it with the experts, by even in my teaching tradition, my teachers emphasize that, like, just play with me, even a scale. Just play with me for half an hour. Like, you know, like, I would do that. My teacher would just play scale, and I'm just doing playing scale, simple things. But, you know, so much knowledge is transmitted. We don't realize it, but those subtleties actually happen in those moments where, when our brain is not like really dissecting or analyzing the form, but we are just absorbing, we're just becoming one with that energy. So I really think that's a very important aspect of being in a musical environment, and, you know, like absorbing it. It's all about exposure in music, like a language.
Yes. I was thinking you'd want to speak about your album Wayfinder and maybe some of your other recorded projects.
I'm currently working on my next recording, which is like, so basically I trained in Western classical music, as I mentioned to you, that I played piano, and then I went to study sitar, and then at some point I realized, oh, I've done a full circle. Now I can actually use the what I learned in Western music and in South Asian music, and as a composer use both, which I love. My music is informed not by one genre. I'm not like a single genre person. Like I delve into many different genres, consciously or unconsciously. I don't think like that. I think whatever comes to me naturally. When I was in Karachi as a 13, 14 year old, I used to listen to Bee Gees like crazy. Like, I thought it's the best thing ever, right? These things have influences on you, and many others, Stevie Wonder and so on. And so music, I think, is should be that way. It's open. Open frontiers, you know, you can go from one place to another. And so in my music, that's a lot of that. In my album Wayfinder, it has actually electronic grooves and beats a lot as well, because I don't know if you can see, this is my pedal board. Can you see that?
Yes.
Yeah. So I use technology. I don't like AI, but I love, you know, things like gadgets and things like that, that actually can, you know, that's still, you know, what a human does. And, you know, we can kind of like change that somewhat. So I am, you will find in my album influences of harmony, electronic sounds, traditional South Asian ragas. But all the compositions are my own. I've composed this music.
Actually, I did want to speak to you about Lullaby for Guli, and maybe if you want to speak about your late mother and her. You say, I think in the album, that she, what did you say, that her story shaped the way you see the world?
My mother used to tell me funny stories, and she used to sing a lot to me, and she used to sing lullabies. And then, you know, like many years after, I realized that, like, you know, how much knowledge, it's not only the love and care. I mean, obviously that's at the heart of everything a mother does, in my experience. But there's a lot of wisdom, funny, you know, like it shapes your character in some ways, you know. Your mom tells you a funny story, a profound story, stories about morals, stories about what's right, and you know, like, so those things like shape you in many ways. And my mother passed away in 2014, and I had spent a lot of time being away from home, so I felt really bad. Like, it's a lot of guilt on me that, oh, I could have spent, you know, this amazing time that's never going to come back. And it took me 4 or 5 years to get some sort of, like, you know, acceptance. And during that time, I wrote this melody called Lullaby for Guli. And I thought that why don't me as a son write a lullaby for mothers? Because mothers are the ones who always sing generously the lullaby. So I thought, like, I want to dedicate this to my mother and to all mothers. So that was the story about Lullaby. And I'm that piece, a lot of people still say that, well, that's my best work. And then I made a video of that.
Yes, I've seen it. Yeah.
Yeah. And the video has been now featured in the South Asian International Film Festival. It was played in a big screen in September this year. I've just been to a screening in Toronto of this as well. And and it was selected as a runner-up in Film House Festival in Berlin. So, so it's getting some attention and airtime, which is and screening. So I'm happy about that.
Be interested. I could share part of that as part of this episode.
No, please share a part of the episode, the video. That'd be amazing.
Okay.
You're about to hear an excerpt from Lullaby for Guli, Tribute to Mothers. The original complete video is linked in the show notes, and the audio is on Mohammed Asani's album Wayfinder.
Also on that album, I really enjoy Transit. Actually, I like the whole album, but it might be in terms of clips we could include. Do you want to speak to that at all?
Yeah, so Transit is basically, I mean, we sometimes talk about the world, oh, look, there is this migration happening, there's this happening. But then I sometimes think that, well, it's always happened. It's nothing new. We have migrated. Like, how did we end up in Canada in the first place, right? So we've already migrated. Yes, I migrated in 2010. So I'm just thinking that migration is like it's like a constant story. The birds are migrating. This and then I'm thinking that, you know, we migrate, but instruments are also migrating, right? An art form migrates as well. And then what happens to that art form? Like in my case, like, you know, I think I'm open to absorbing. So like, since I came to Canada, I became interested in electronic music. Before, I wasn't really doing much electronic music as such. Electronic, not in the kind of like high art electronic music. I mean, electronic music in terms of like me using, you know, DAWs and gadgets and things like that. And so transit is like a reflection of like, you know, migration. That's we are in transit, like, you know, all the time. And there's an interesting video that as well of transit on YouTube as well that I did, and it's kind of fast paced. So transit has a lot of influences and a lot of fast rhythmic things, and yeah. So that's and then the melody is traditional of that piece, but it's really adapted to stretch and show this kind of like some sort of like movement that it goes out from its original form. Often I start in this raga called Bhairavi, but then I completely go into in a very different direction. So you will see the notes change dramatically, which something doesn't happen in raga music. Raga music starts with a certain raga and stays in that raga throughout, but you will see a lot of variety in that response, in that sense.
This next excerpt is from Transit, which is from the album Wayfinder.
Since you put out that album, like in 2022, you had this beautiful single, Solace.
Yeah, Solace, I really like. I really like. Basically, like I'm really in love. So basically, I'll just show you the tuning for Solace. I mean, tuning is always going to take time. So there's the scale. So five notes, pentatonic, but it's a very different sort of pentatonic, yeah? From we have like a tonic, minor second, then fourth, fifth, and sixth. So it's omits the second and the seventh. So I find that it's a very pensive kind of raga. It's called Gulkali. It's a very pensive. I like the space between the notes, and it just evokes. Sometimes, like a raga like this itself leads to a melody that only so many places you can go. But then one thing that I did, that it's called a 9-beat cycle that I also really love, and like for many years as a musician, I would just declare myself as a failed musician because I could not play in 7 beats, or I, you know, like I thought, oh, if I play in 4 beats, like everybody does that, like, you know, why can't I play in 8.5 beat, or why can't I do 9 beat, or this and that. And these are really like your ego talking to you. And also in South Asian Indian classical Hindustani music, there's a lot of that. Oh, I'm playing something in 8.5 beats, so I'm doing this, and people will. There's a lot of like people kind of mystified a lot, you know. But when you come down to it, when you learn it, then it's there's no mystery to it. It's just like doing the act of doing. And often, like if somebody's saying I'm playing in 8.5 beat, they're not really playing in an 8.5 beat. They just so for example, like if I say 9 beats, like 1, 2, 3, four, five, six, one, two, three, four, five, six, one. So I'm playing six, and then I'm playing three, but I'm doing it double speed. So it sounds like the total math is like one, two, three, four, five, six, one, two, three, four, five, six, one. That was nine beats, right?
Okay.
So I'm cheating in that sense. I'm not cheating. It's just the way the rhythm is structured. The last three beats are broken into one, two, three, one, two, three. Yeah. So that's easy to feel. But if I was to actually take it as just one beat, then it becomes very difficult to do nine beats or nine and a half or eight and a quarter. So we use this thing called Savari, which is like these like little kind of phrases, riffs, which is easy to do. So like, so the riff is day, day, na, day, day, na. That's the riff. One, two, three, one, two, three. And then, so I'm playing six. Then, terekit, day, na, two, na, day, day, na, day, day, na. Then, terekit, day, na, two, na, day, day, na, day, day, na. One, two, three, four, five, six. They. So it's not quite nine beat in the sense that like I'm not doing like, not every beat is equal. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
The last three beats are at double speed. So which, so I'm just saying is that like, when you don't know these things, you think, oh, it's impossible. How do I do that? I'm not this and that, you know, you challenge yourself. And, but obviously if nobody tells you, then you're not going to, and you could do, but like, you know, so it's no point beating yourself. So one thing that I found from learning this music is that it's all very scientific. It's all doable. There's no mysticism. The mysticism comes from your spirit, how you present that thing, but the actual thing is just like as tangible as anything.
Now you'll be hearing an excerpt from Solace with the tabla player Ustad Shahbaz Hussain and Mohammed Asani.
classical music, you can analyze sonata form to no end, but you cannot analyze Beethoven's spirit. I don't know. Sounds cheesy, but that's what I'm trying to say.
For sure, yeah. Mohammed, I was thinking, I mean, this came up with another guest recently, Michael Bridge, the accordionist. You know, I was asking him about the intuitive versus the analytical, because the accordion is a very technical instrument. They have to sort of set things up ahead of time. But I think with all, when you're learning and teaching and playing music, there's really both sides that get engaged at different times, right? The yes. analysis and the intuitive.
Yeah, yeah. It's a bit like driving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing that, oh, how does one drive? Like, you just panic. What the hell? Like, you know, what if that didn't go right? But we drive without thinking. I mean, we do think, we see, mm-hmm. but we're not constantly analyzing all this. It just happens, you know. I think when you spend a lot of time with an instrument, like accordion, we're complex, you know, like you're figuring all these chords and, but, you know. But I think from the act of doing it, and it just happened. Mm-hmm. To still this day, sometimes when I'm going on the stage, I'm saying that, what if I don't remember this, or what if I don't? But somehow our brains are better than what we give mm-hmm. them credit for, right? They somehow get us through.
Yeah. You've played with this tabla player. He must be your friend, Shahbaz Hussein. He's on all your albums. But he lives in Europe?
He lives in London.
Okay.
Near Manchester, in a town called Rochdale.
Okay. So has he come over to Vancouver for your
He's come over one? Many times. He and okay. I'm actually hoping to get him over this year as well. He is, absolutely fantastic tabla player. When he plays, and by the way, he sings on Solace. So mm-hmm. the voice that you hear is him.
Yeah,
he's one of those rhythm players who's so melodic in every single way. And his knowledge of raga is next to anybody I know. He will know about every... So melodically, he knows so much. Like, he's a tabla player. And I often say, tease him. I said, like, you know, give up tabla. Either play, sing or play sitar. Because he's so... capable, yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's a joke. So I work with him. He really inspires me. Fantastic tabla player. He's learned from three different teachers. So sometimes there are taboos, like, you know, like that, oh, you must have one teacher.
Because
mm-hmm. your teacher will be so upset if you even dare to look at another teacher. But things are changing, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was fortunate to go to three different teachers. He went to a very legendary teacher called Ustad Mia Shaukat Hussain from Pakistan. And he lived with him for like 6 years, 7 years. He also learned from Ustad Fayaz Khan from Delhi in India, and who visited frequently in England. So he's groomed by these two amazing. And for a short time, he also learned from the Zakir Hussain's father, Ustad Allah Rakha Khan. So like three of the best ustads like in music. So that shows in his playing. Yeah.
And you got to know him when you were in England.
Yeah, I lived near him. So mm-hmm. I've known him for the last 20 years. And then gradually we started playing. And then by the time I was coming to Canada, we've become too close. Like, he was like my best friend. So I missed him a lot. And then so that I brought him. But musically, he's not like from both point of view, like as a friend and as a musician. In musically, he, in my opinion, he's in the top 10 tabla players in the world.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of tabla players in the world.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I know you participated, actually, you were sort of one of the lead people in the 80th birthday celebration, the Aga Khan, and that concert's on YouTube. I watched part of it.
That was really a moving experience. And so we arrived in Paris, and then we had like about like 5 or 6 days. So on the first day, I think there were like 19 musicians from different parts of the world, from Syria, from Canada, from Afghanistan, from France, from UK. And everybody was different. Like, everybody brought different instruments or voices. And we had to come up with one piece. like one piece which had a combination of other pieces in it. So it was like a so we all had ideas. I suggested that, like, why don't we break ice and give 2 3 minutes to each artist? They sing or perform for everybody, then we know what palette we have for this amazing thing. And it was a journey. People cried, people got excited, people got upset, and so on, as humans do, right? We are humans. And in the end, we got a seamless piece that was about 24 minutes. And the last piece was instrumental piece that I led within that. You'll hear sitar, you'll hear rabab, you'll hear a saz from Tajikistan, and beautiful voices and percussions. And you'll hear Sarah, she lives Tower, she's an amazing jazz drummer, she plays on it as well. So we had fun. It was quite like, I like these kind of situations, that you are thrown into a situation. It's completely unknown. Like, it was completely unknown. We didn't know how it was going to be. And we had 27 ideas, and I believe four were selected in the end.
Okay.
Yeah.
You studied the Ustad Ashraf Sharif Khan.
Ashraf Khan, yeah.
So I'm assuming it was kind of traditional way of studying it.
So when I mentioned that I used to play scales with my ustad, that was with Ustad Ashraf Sharif Khan. He would, so basically, whatever, I studied from him for not very long time, my exposure to mature, but he would just get me to sit and play with him, like, repetitively. And he, in his word, he would say that, like, I'm transforming my energy to you, literally. And I felt that, because he was taking me to an intensity that I had never experienced before. And it were simple things, like, anytime that somebody wants to play something really fast and you're struggling, breathe a bit. You will find a remarkable kind of, like, okay, you regain your composure a bit. So, like, these kind of small things that are huge, in my opinion. Yeah, so I studied with him, yeah.
I was wondering if the way you teach what, how is it different or how is it informed by your mentors?
Yeah, I'm a rebel, by the way. So my teachers would tell me something, I would always interpret it in my own way, in a way. And when I teach, I think I have my own way of teaching. And also because, like, I was when I went to England, I was on a degree course, and honestly, I'd only learned about Mozart and Beethoven like 6 7 months before. And then I had to deal with reading music, which I still find it challenging, because it's not something that I took on as a child. So reading, I can read, but I'm not like, okay, give it to me. And especially when you read on sitar, it's even like crazier, because it's too much. So what I'm saying is that, like, I then find my own ways to get around it, basically. And my musical training has anything but normal, I would say. It's different. Like, I feel that, like, any situation I've been there, it was like different. Like, I don't know how to explain that, but I didn't go through the traditional route. Although, yes, I have done traditional. I studied traditional Western classical music. I studied traditional Hindustani music, but my entry into that wasn't like a typical, say.
And if people want, I forget the name of, oh yeah, Spirit of Tradition. You ha do have an album if people want to hear
Yeah, with
traditional.
traditional music, yeah, with Shabazz, yeah.
You know, there's a quote, I think it might be on your website, where you say that when you learned the sitar, it helped you with your relationship with yourself. It taught you patience. So maybe just to close out this conversation, could you reflect on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think, like, it's like when you learn one thing in your life seriously, and you dedicate and you think about it, it kind of like, what reflects back at you are other p things in your life where you could improve, or where you're not improving, and then you can see, or at least that, you know, you kind of start to understand who you are. Sitar to me will always be a challenge, right? It's the music is bigger than us, I believe. So if I can do something like that, what do I learn from it? It just gives me a lot of things to reflect about me as a person. We have a common saying that, like, this is an oral tradition, and everybody's playing the same rag. So, you know, like, they're taught similarly in a way of, like, a traditional composition. A tabla will come. It's very, like, you know, it's very scripted. You know, it's, you know exactly what's going to happen. It's going to end with a rhythmic thing at the end. But everybody plays very differently, and it's the personality that comes out in a music like this. So your own personality. So then you're forced to think about it, that, okay, this is me, Muhammad, playing sitar. Am I agitated a lot? Am I rushing through things? Am I, you know, those are the dialogues that a musician has in this kind of style of music. Why is it not having an effect? I'm playing the right notes. The rhythm is right. There is a doubt. Why, you know, is that doubt in my personality? You know, so you start having these kind of conversation with yourself. And once you accept that whoever you are is going to show on the stage, and that happens, right? Mm-hmm. So then you start, like, you know, maybe, like, you start fine tuning some aspects of yourself. Maybe if I'm not breathing, I start breathing. You know, maybe I have some nervousness. So then you figure out ways of being. In a nutshell, you start actually looking at yourself as well as the music, and try to make that connection between yourself and the music. And I think that's the only time when the music happens, when you're connected, when your soul is connected, and when you're not in your ego somewhat, yeah.
Beautifully said. I can't agree more. And I'll just tell listeners, you've done this wonderful series that I think it's linked on your website for CBC Radio, South Asian Music segment, I guess, and, like, history and culture. And I've started to listen to them. Really fantastic resource.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
So thanks so much for this today.
My absolute pleasure. My absolute pleasure, Leah. Wonderful to speak with you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode with Mohammed, and I wanted to let you know that this is my final episode for Season 3, and Season 4 launches January 6th. Please sign up for my newsletter at leahroseman.com to get access to sneak peeks for upcoming episodes, and share your favorite episodes with your friends. I normally say have a great week, but I'll take this opportunity to say best wishes for 2024, and do check out my back catalog for episodes you may have missed over Seasons 1 through 3.